A statesman of high caliber who commands attention, respect, and influence in Washington and the nation. It is my honor and privilege at this moment to call upon our junior United States Senator, Senator Eugene J. McCarthy, to speak to you. Senator McCarthy.
President Sewell and officers of the Minnesota Newspaper Association, our guests here tonight, Mr. Reuter and Mr. Strauss, and members of this organization. I was afraid that Art might go all the way in explaining how much I'd proved in being elected to the Senate here. I was in a group soon after I was elected, and someone had gone on about how I was the first McCarthy to get elected here and how I'd overcome a number of other what appeared to be traditional handicaps to candidates. I'd begun to feel as though I'd really accomplished something until I heard someone say, well, it might prove all those things, but it might prove that anybody could have been elected in 1958. I'd have to add to what Mr. Strauss had to say. He said he was almost interested in the political future of Minnesota. I'm sure that he is, but I'm interested in that and also in the economic future of this state, as well as in the future of the newspapers and anything else that all the other things, I should say, that people in this state are concerned about. I, of course, am on the Finance Committee, and we suffer some special difficulties on that committee. All of us looked forward this year to cutting taxes. We thought most everyone would be in favor of that until we began the effort and found that this didn't seem to be the popular disposition. As a matter of fact, there were many of us who were not really persuaded of that, and I think it has been encouraging to note that the people in the country are not arbitrarily and without any real reflection in favor of tax cuts for the sake of tax cuts. We do have some obligation. I hope it will be shared in some measure by the press in explaining why it is good to have larger deficits sometimes, that a balanced budget is not the greatest good for the economy or for the political economy, but we'll have, I think, 6 or 8 months in which to attempt to make that particular case. I was afraid that Art would get up and read telegrams from every other member of Congress whom you invited here, explaining how they couldn't be here because they were so busy in Washington because of the burden of their work, and I would have to explain my being here. I note only he may still have this in mind, so I want to anticipate it in case he does have these telegrams. At least we're not in session on Washington's birthday. But I have a special reason for, well, I think for having been and for being invited, and a special reason for accepting. 1 year, some 6 or 8 years ago, I was member of the House of Representatives then, and you were meeting in St. Paul. Now, I had not been invited to speak, but I'd been invited to the dinner, as I recall. Perhaps I hadn't been, but in any case, I ran into the chairman of the meeting in the St. Paul Hotel, and he said, you know, we have invited, it was not my colleague, Senator Humphrey, but another member of the House to speak tonight, and we've just gotten word that he may not be able to land here. It was a bad night. And he said, we'd like to have you stand by. Well, that wasn't so bad. I knew I was taking a chance because I'd been introduced one time to substitute for Senator Humphrey in the here in northern Minnesota, and the man introduced me by saying, I have sad news for you. I was afraid that same thing might happen, but in any case, they carried me to the point of having me at the head table because the other speaker had not yet arrived, and I was almost ready to go when he did arrive. So I was really a captive audience. As I remember, he spoke for an hour and 15 minutes, Art. So I had an invitation coming, really. I'll not speak for an hour and 15 minutes. If I had him here as a captive, I might. I'm going to talk to you in general about the press in Washington and about our common responsibilities. I know some of you thought that I might make a protest about how press may be unfair to Democrats. I want you to know that I don't believe this to be the case. I think you're fair with us. I think you're unfair in dealing with the Republicans. You treat them better than they deserve. There's been a great deal of discussion within the last 6 or 8 months at least, on the question of censorship and the control of the news on the part of the government agencies. Sometimes the complaint is that not enough news is released by the administration, and sometimes the complaint is that the papers carry too much. Usually when the news is good, why, the complaint is that there's too much of it being carried. And when it's bad, why, they say there's not enough of it being released by the administration. I note that this week, at least in the magazines, that we have Mrs. Kennedy on the cover of two of the popular magazines, and we have the Attorney General on the cover of another. This would perhaps be more than enough news for some people. But on the serious question of the control of serious news, I think all of us realize that this is a kind of continuing controversy and a continuing struggle in a democratic free society like ours. And the press must be engaged in a continuous effort to see to it that that news to which they have a right, or which beyond them the people of the country have a right to, are not closed off. As a matter of fact, when dealing with the executive branch of the government, this is something which is of concern to us who are in the legislative branch of the government, because we do have some differences with them. We sometimes feel that we're not being given even that amount of information which we need in order to make the, well, perhaps somewhat limited decisions that are left to us, but in any case, decisions which we think must be based upon the information, upon the facts, and whatever good opinion there may be in the executive branch of the government that bears upon those particular decisions. And I think this is the general standard, that the press and the members of Congress and beyond them, the citizens, have a right to that news and that information which is necessary to them in order to make the decisions that they're called upon to make. This is a kind of relative standard, I suppose, a kind of moving one, which does leave some room for interpretation, some room for discretion and prudence on the part of those who have direct and immediate control over news information. But we must acknowledge that at best it will be a kind of moving standard. I'm sure that those who are in control of the news, the executive branch of the government, which has the greatest responsibility for most important decisions, are always moved somewhat to keep back, to make mistakes if they make them, on the side of excessive security. They can, I'm sure, in every administration, state and national, recall incidents when an idle word or a misinterpretation or some bit of information which they had not intended to have public did have a somewhat serious effect upon international relations. And of course, when you have international affairs in somewhat delicate balance in which they exist today, the temptation, if we can call it that, to be even more restrictive, I suppose, becomes somewhat more intense. Simple words like bilateral, a word that was mentioned within the last day or two, in terms of bilateral conversations with the Russians. We've been charged on the part of the people of Germany, for example, that this meant that we were going to negotiate with regard to Berlin. Well, the poor man who used the word said, well, we'll talk to everybody, but we can only talk to one person at a time. It would be, I suppose, if everyone were talking, there's no one time when you can be speaking really in conversation, two people, one after the other at least. But question of the word or question of the interpretation does set up a disposition on the part of a government in control of news to be somewhat too restrictive. My general judgment is that they must at all times be disposed to take some chances on the way of being more trustful or more liberal in the way of the news that they give out, and to rely upon the press to exercise some restraint, and beyond that, to rely upon the people to exercise some measure of good judgment, whether our own people or people in other countries, our allies, those with whom we deal. On the side of excessive control, I suppose the most disturbing statement made recently was that of Arthur Sylvester in the Pentagon. I'm sure that if he were called upon to explain it in detail, it would not sound as harsh as it did in the literal representation, in which he practically said that there were no limits upon the way in which news could be used to advance the objectives of the government. Well, I'm sure he doesn't accept it, and I know none of us here accept it, because there must be some kind of moral judgment passed upon the news that is released, and there must be some reasonable standards as to what you can say, what you cannot say, or what you should say, and what you should not say. It's a second area in which I've been somewhat concerned, and I think newspaper men are concerned, and that this is not a new development either, but the practice of using what might be called special reporters, sometimes in the device of the background press conference or news conference, in which you supposedly are told things that you ought to know, as a kind of based upon which to pass judgment upon things which you do know. This is a kind of contradictory sort of proposition, but the newspaper people, some do respond to it in Washington, and some of them stand apart saying, it's sometimes self-serving, but they're professional position is we shouldn't be involved in this, we ought to stand apart and be pure about it, be reporters and nothing else. The other explanation is that if they don't go to the background conference, they can find out what was said there and use it without prejudice to themselves. This is not quite so ethical and quite so professional. Practice also of having a kind of private reporter who is on the inside. This was a part of the difficulty with reference to Governor Stevenson and the most recent Cuban problem at the United Nations, in which one reporter supposedly was taken up the mountain above the clouds to see what really went on, and then came down again to report it. There's some difference, I think, between taking a reporter who is a man of professional status and carrying your own historian. I think most rulers, kings and presidents, have always had their private historians. Oftentimes the history has to be rewritten, but in any case, it's an ancient practice, and if someone like Arthur Schlesinger, as they say in Washington, he wrote The Age of Jackson after it occurred, and The Age of Roosevelt while it was happening, and he's writing this age somewhat in advance of the event. I think that's somewhat too harsh a judgment on Arthur and his role, but in any case, the practice of the inside reporter is one which I think does raise, can be considered professional and ethical questions with regard to the practice of journalism at this time, and it's one which has been a problem to us really throughout those administrations with which I've been familiar. Now, on the other hand, there are some weaknesses and some faults in the Washington press. I'll not talk about the Minnesota press. But in Washington, we do have some problems, and you depend upon them to some extent. I don't think this is just the Washington press, but it's that press with which I deal almost every day. I think, in a sense, there are perhaps too many reporters there. This means that after the AP and the UP and the other wire services have filed their reports and the basic stories have been sent out, they begin looking around for other things to report, sometimes insignificant events, sometimes distortions of what really happened, sometimes a kind of searching for headlines, not in many cases real falsification, but they're under a kind of pressure to set up what may appear to be conflicts. They'll write a story about the president in conflict with the Congress. Well, sometimes this is true, and sometimes it's not true. Sometimes the conflict is within the Congress itself. Sometimes it's headlined as a conflict between liberals and conservatives. Sometimes this is true as it's presented, and sometimes it's not true. Most recently, they talked about the effort to pack the Finance Committee, and it was reported that the defeat of this effort was a great blow to the president's tax program in the United States Senate. Well, this is really not accurate reporting, because of a number of things that exist in the committee itself. In the Senate, it's not so important to have numbers on a committee as to have two or three people who can ably represent a certain position. And certainly on that committee, there are two or three people who can ably present a position on taxes. As one of our men said, the only group that's overrepresented on that committee now are the populists. This is almost true. We do have a few people on the committee who would solve all our problems in terms of the populist low-interest program that had some strength in this state 50 or 100 years ago. But in any case, a distortion and a misrepresentation of what was really involved and of what the consequences of the action really were. I don't say that this is always an effort to get a headline, but there is a tendency to try to give it just a little bit different slant, or a somewhat different interpretation, or a slightly different emphasis. A second tendency is that of, I suppose, of reporters going beyond the effort at reporting and presenting things as though they had discovered special facts, a kind of expose following a private investigation. Now, there are things that reporters need to investigate. There are some things that members of Congress need to investigate. But I don't think either members of Congress or reporters ought to make their reputation year in and year out as investigators. But there is an area of positive action and of positive effort in which they ought really to be tested. We've had something of this recently with regard to Cuba. Members of Congress who declared that they had special intelligence sources. And of course, unless you want to claim that you have special intelligence sources yourself, which are better than the other man's, or which are better than those which the administration has, you're in a rather difficult position. You're forced almost to make a choice, saying, well, I'll choose between his sources of intelligence and those which the administration has, take his position, or to put some trust in the President and the Central Intelligence Agency and the Secretary of the Army and the Secretary of Defense and the Pentagon. But in these operations, particularly in the last, if you followed it very closely, there were questions asked, but they were always within certain limitations. What was the difference between, let us say, June 24th and October the 24th? Not between June the 1st and January the 1st, but in particular dates. Or what happened between October 24th and January 24th or 14th? Or the practice of putting certain words in quotations. I've never been quite sure as to what this really means. I suppose what it means is that once you put it in quotations, when you put your own words in quotations, I can see what you do when you put other people's words in quotations. You either mean this is what he said, and I understood what he said, or I don't know what he means when he uses this word. But when you put your own words in quotations, it either means that you don't know what the word means, in which case you shouldn't have used it, or you don't use it in the same way in which other people use it. So you read the charges on the part of some of these people, but you look down and you find quotation marks around certain words, not attributed to anyone else. And then also you put words in parentheses. Well, I don't know what it means when you put them in parentheses, but these are new diacritical markings which need to be interpreted if you're really going to communicate with the general public. The tendency to oversimplify, of course, there is a need to simplify in the representation of governmental problems, but the difficulty arises when you determine to what extent you can simplify. And the line between proper simplification and oversimplification, of course, is one which faces newspaper men as it also faces those of us who exist in Congress. There seems to come a time when most Washington reporters are tempted to be columnists. And there are several reasons for this. I think one is financial. But in addition to that, I think they watch members of Congress pass rash judgments and decide that, well, if they can do it, why, we can too. And I think you have to allow in a difficult world that some people are going to finally pass judgments which are somewhat rash, but those of us who are in the Senate think that the privilege ought to be restricted to us, if at all possible. We have to have some special area of operation, and we'd like to restrict this. The basic difficulty comes to something, I think, pretty close to this analysis, that You should always, insofar as possible, have a proper balance in any person or in any office between power and responsibility. You may have responsibility without power, and this makes really for general ineffectiveness. We sometimes feel that way in the Senate. On the other hand, you may have power without responsibility, and I think that is even more dangerous. So what we need to be concerned about in the operation of government and in your judgment upon us, and not only upon us, but upon other institutions in society, to first of all to seek to establish this kind of balance between the power people have and their responsibility, or their responsibilities and the power that they have. And when you're not satisfied that that balance does exist, then the kind of judgment which you pass, either because of the inadequacy of power or because of the lack of responsibility, is a somewhat different kind of judgment. There is in Washington, too, a disposition to, well, this is, I think, primarily among the colonists, to carry on a little bit the way the blackbirds do in the fall, when they sit on the telephone line and one flies away and they all fly away. And then one comes back and they all come back. So they'll take an issue, and whether they're all persuaded for a day or whether they're afraid they'll be wrong if they don't fly away is never quite determined. But you can't add up, really, the position taken by all of the columnists and all of the reporters out of Washington and say, well, the majority of them have said this today, therefore it must be right. The tendency on the part of newspaper people sometimes to press too hard on questions. I think Mae Craig in the presidential conference the other day stated the extreme position when she said to the president she thought he ought to tell the press everything they wanted to know. This is, I think, somewhat extreme, but there is a tendency sometimes to ask questions which should not be asked, sometimes for personal reasons. I think Mrs. Kennedy made a rather good response recently when a reporter sent her a note on the airplane saying, what do you feed your new dog? And she wrote back a note saying, newspaper men. This was the kind of question which they really didn't need to ask. I don't know why there was any secrecy on it, but in any case, it was somewhat impertinent. If the question was not impertinent, the manner in which he intruded into the privacy was impertinent. But sometimes the questions are too searching and too aggressive and sometimes indiscriminate. And sometimes, of course, we know if the answer were given, the interpretation might result in misrepresentation and in great confusion. Well, in any case, this is a common problem which we have. All of you here, I know, are aware of the importance of the press and the part it plays in the public life of this United States. All of us here believe in freedom of the press and talk a great deal about it, and of course we must and must continue to do so. But I think that each of us who claims this freedom to speak, or freedom to print, freedom to publish, must occasionally, too, give some thought to the basis upon which we claim it. And when we do it, we don't really come back to saying, I, as an individual, have a right to do this simply because I'm free to say what I want to say, but rather it comes to something, I think, more fundamental. It's based in the right and the need of every person to advance in the search and in the comprehension of truth. So that our right to freedom of speech really relates to something which is more fundamental and which is outside of us but rests in other people, namely their right to the truth, and not only their right to it, but their need for the truth. And so whenever we speak, whenever we print, we must keep in mind this more fundamental right, and therefore take some, first of all, some real trouble to know what we're talking about and to proceed to say it with a basic respect, first of all, for the meaning of every word, and along with that, a basic respect for truth itself. And this responsibility, I think, is especially pressing in this, the last half of the 20th century, for a number of reasons. Let me cite just one or two of them. The first is that, really, the mass of the volume of history today, those things which are a part of current history, which call upon us for some attention and for some judgment and some commitment, that this is greater than it's ever been before. Every part of the world, in a sense, and every problem in the world is now brought to our attention. It calls and demands of us some measure of attention, not the same in every area, but at least some attention, and in some cases, rather serious commitment. And the second change that's taken place is that the movement of history and the movement of life today is at a rate which is faster than it's ever been before. In part, this schedule is made by our enemies, but more importantly, it's made by the very movement of history itself. And so many decisions are called for, and many interpretations, and many judgments. And the press, in a very special way today, must stand between the centers of power, and there are great centers of power today, in politics, in our economic system, in the control of ideas, to mention perhaps the three most important ones. And the press stands, in a sense, as a defender of the people against these concentrations of power. This is a great challenge and a great responsibility. And you must exercise this obligation to interpret and to correct and to clarify, a special burden which you and I together share.